A nice looking young woman came into my office years ago, back in the 90s. We'll call her Tamara. If your name is Tamara, don't freak out. I'm not talking about you, okay? And she was dating a guy that I knew. His name, we'll call him Gary. These are fictitious names, you understand, right? So if your name is Gary, don't hyperventilate. So Gary was dating Tamara, and they'd been dating for a while, and he was divorced, had two children. And she wanted to know for me in my office, you know, should I continue to date Gary? And I really love him. Do you think I should marry him? And so I knew some about Gary, knew some about her, and she told me more things about their relationship. And so after she asked me those questions, should I continue to date him and do you think I should marry him? This is basically, in a nutshell, the response that I gave her. Number one, you should not marry him because he's not a Christian. And the Bible's very clear, if you have studied the New Testament and listened to Paul, you don't even have to go to seminary to know the counsel. What did Paul say? Don't be what? Unequally yoked. Don't do it, because it comes with great complexities. It doesn't mean that because I know many people are, because it happens a variety of ways. Some people are two non-Christians and one gets saved after you become a Christian, and there's complexities. But Paul says if you can marry another believer, do that, because then Christ is at the center of your relationship. And there's strength there. So 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 14, be not unequally yoked. And so I told her, scripture's pretty clear. And I know Gary's a great guy. If he doesn't know the Lord, he won't be the priest of your family. It's probably not God's choice for you. Number two, you say that when you go to his house and you hang out there, that his teenage sons F-bomb you all the time. That is not a good sign. And they mock you, they make fun of you, they torment you. And so if you are under delusions that you're going to get a marriage certificate and they're going to automatically love you, that's probably not going to happen. It's only going to get worse. Number three, the fact that Gary will not stop them from mocking you to your face is problematic. Because as a man, that's telling me a whole lot of things about him, and it's not good stuff. Because what should the man do? Step into the face of an 18-year-old and say, hey, you don't talk to women like that, etc. But he didn't. And he was a big, muscle-bound guy. So number four, I was a chaplain for 1,300 officers, sheriff officers, and he was a vice cop, and I knew that. And so I told her, I said, you know, as a vice officer, with what he deals with, his specialty is pedophilia. Thank God for men like him, women too, that deal with that. But I can just tell you, from being the chaplain, it takes a toll on a person. And so you just must realize, if you marry him, that heavy baggage that he deals with his job, it hangs on him. And you're going to have to be there, strength and support for him. Are you ready to do that? And so based on those things, she looked at me and she was crying and said, you know, hey, Pastor Marty, you know, thank you for telling me what I needed to hear. I know this is what God wanted me to do. I just had to hear it from you. Thank you. I praise God for you. Blah, blah, blah. What do you think happened? You guys are unbelievable. Just, you're so smart. Yeah, she married him. She married him. How do you think that marriage went? What do you think? It was bad. It was very bad. I think it ended in divorce. It was very bad, very tragic. Because everything I told her, not that I'm a prophet or a son of the prophet, but I'm a logical person. I can kind of look at the facts, and it didn't last. And if she had listened to wise counsel, she came for wise counsel. I gave it to her, and she didn't want to do it. Why? Because she was thinking with her, not her head, but with her heart, and she disregarded the facts in front of her and went ahead and married him anyway. I would call that, this is a scholastic definition, a dumb decision. And lest you look at her and go, golly, what's her problem? Stop and ask yourself a real personal question. Have I ever made a dumb decision? See, now you're quiet. Yeah. You might have done this recently. And you're like thinking, what in the world was I thinking? Yeah, because it's just another way to look at it is a lame decision. It's the one where you don't really consider God. You don't consider wisdom. You just consider yourself. And that's exactly what Tamara did with Gary. And it's exactly what David's going to do. Thousands of years before this couple hit the planet, David's making his own issues. Now, he's known as a man after God's own heart, and he was, but he's a man. And so sometimes he didn't follow God's heart. He followed David's heart. And this is a situation in this chapter where he is going to make a decision, well, more than one decision, that's just absolutely jaw-dropping. You're like, Can you believe what he just did? And when we get to the end of this chapter, you're going to see what he learned from this situation. Because if you are in the process of making a bad decision, or you're living with the results of the bad decision, God is in all of that. He has not forgotten you. It's not over for you. And that's what we're going to see in this passage, that God was there with David through all of the mess that he's going to create. But it all starts with what I call the ruse. R-U-S-E, the ruse, like the deception. Now, you think about David's life. As before we get into verse 1, this is still introductory material. You still with me? See why 15 verses can be a long time? Think about his life to this point. He's defeated Goliath with how many stones? One. I mean, he had a couple more backup, but just one. And pretty much after that, he had some military victories, but his personal life just fell apart. Why? Well, the king Saul absolutely hated David. He was jealous of him, envious of him. And so he used all of his power as the king to eliminate him. So David's life fell apart there. He tried to take David out on multiple occasions. First, remember, by way of review, he told him, hey, marry my oldest daughter. David's like, oh, what I got to do? Well, from the text, we can kind of intimate that he was going to be, oh, you can't pay the dowry? Well, fight a couple battles with the Philistines, and if you live, you can have her. He's hoping he gets killed on the battlefield, but he's like, well, I don't want to marry your oldest daughter. You know, sometimes if you're going to marry somebody, you got to connect, right? And if you're looking at him going, she's not my style, you know? So he goes to daughter number two. Well, Michal, oh, she absolutely thinks you're all that in a bag of chips. I mean, she wants to marry you. Want to marry her? Yeah, well, yeah. No, that's my kind of woman. Okay, Michal, yeah, what do I have to do for a dowry for her? Do you remember the dowry? No one's going to say. They didn't in the first service either. It's kind of gross. You got to bring me 100 foreskins of 100 dead Philistines. Dangerous. You got to be kidding me. What's he do? He brings 200. He lives. Saul's trying to take him out. He tries to throw a spear at him while he's playing the harp, tries to kill him with a spear. That's his father-in-law. If your father-in-law's throwing spears at you, there's some problems in the family. He misses the new moon festival, doesn't show up, you know, for the meal. Saul finds out, you know, through Jonathan, his son, that his son is helping David. And then Saul throws a spear at his son, I mean, which told Jonathan and David, my dad really wants to kill you. So what's David do? Well, as his life fell apart and pressure mounted in his life, the whole country is against him to take him out. And so instead of having great faith, he has great fear. You ever been there? Your life's falling apart. God's removing the supportive structure of your life. And you're wondering, what in the world is going on? And God's like, well, you need to lean on me in faith and not be fearful. And David's like a great man of faith, but he's going to forget his faith for a while. And he's going to embrace fear. Not that you ever done this? Have you ever done this? This is a confessional booth. I think it's large. Yeah. Fear is going to overtake him. So now let's check out the ruse. Verse 1. David says when he was fleeing Saul after the spear episode with Jonathan, then he came to this really well-known town called Nob. You live in where? Not Nob. Nob. Why is he there? Well, that's where the priests are, right? He goes to Ahimelech, the priest, or he's the high priest. Ahimelech came trembling to meet David. He's scared to death to meet David. And he said to him, I have a question. Why are you alone? And no one's with you? I mean, you're a major military person. You usually have an entourage of soldiers with you. Why are you alone? And David said to Ahimelech the priest, oh, well, the king has commissioned me with a matter. It's a secret matter. And he said to me, let no one know anything about the matter on which I am sending you, with which I have commissioned you. And I have directed the young man to a certain place. The young man being his entourage, his other buddies, his military men. So he lied to the priest. Do you think people have ever lied to me as a pastor? And the answer is definitely yes. Yeah, they've lied straight to my face before, only to call me later and tell me. I've had people call me and tell me, I am so sorry because my wife was absolutely right in what she said I was doing. I absolutely was doing it. I just deceived you. I mean, I've heard it all at this point in my pastoral career. So the fact that he's lying to the high priest, I've seen that happen. And if you're lying to your spiritual leader, this is not a good sign. Because if you can lie to the spiritual leader like a pastor, you'll lie to anybody, right? Not good. So he lies to the priest and tells the priest, why am I here? I'm on a special mission from God. He's like the Blues Brothers. I'm on a special, If you remember who they are, I'm probably dating myself, but I probably lost half the audience. One guy, one sermon, didn't even know who Clint Eastwood was. I'm like, are you an American? Anyway, back to my sermon. And so he tells him a lie right to his face. I'm on a special mission from God, and I got soldiers hiding off in the hills, and that's why I'm here. Now, what you don't see David doing here on his run, he's in fear, you don't see him in this section praying. Because if you're running in fear, you don't talk to God. You're listening to your heart. I mean, remember Tamara? She wasn't listening to God. She's listening to her heart. I'm getting older. I want to have children. I found a guy. At least I think he loves me, blah, blah, blah. She's listening to her heart and not to the evidence. And so in this situation, you have a similar thing going on. And David's in this priestly town talking to the priest, but you don't see him talking to God because he's running in fear. He's seeking his will and way, not God's. So what does he need while he's on the run? Basically three things: food, water, and a weapon. That's what he thinks he needs: food, water, and a weapon. So where does he think he can get these? He thinks he can get them from the high priest. And so he shows up to talk to Ahimelech, and he tells the king, who is scared to death, two lies. Number one, I'm on special assignment from the king. Number two, I have a bunch of soldiers with me that are hiding when they really weren't hiding. Two lies. Seems kind of innocent at this point. But he's fearful of, can I trust this priest or not? Why in the world did Ahimelech, the great-grandson of Eli, the former high priest, why was he trembling in his tunic when he met David? He's like, it's David. Oh, man, this is scary. Why? Because he realizes something fishy is going on. What seems fishy? Well, he's heard scuttlebutt in the country that the king's trying to kill David. Everybody knows it. And all of a sudden, David shows up at his doorstep. He's got no weapon, and he's one of their leading soldiers. He's got no weapon, and he says he's got men, but I can't see him. So are they called spidey senses? Is that what they're called? It's a newer term. It's kind of out of my, but I know what it is. So what is a spidey sense? Something what? Something ain't right. Thank you. That's a astute definition. Something ain't right. In my day and age, we'd call this like a baloney meter. You know what I'm saying? This is total baloney. You know, like when somebody's telling you something and you're considering the fact and you're going, spidey senses, something, right? Older person like me is like, baloney meter just pegged. That is lame. And so he's afraid that David's up to something. So David calms the high priest's fears with lies. It's what he does. He says, I need food and I need weaponry. He said, I left Dodge so fast, I didn't have time to grab my weapons. Serious? Everything about him was a lie. Fear makes you do bizarre things. Have you ever been so fearful that you didn't act logically and make sound decisions? And then you look back later, what was I thinking? Fear absolutely just freezes you up. It makes you act like David. So David's lying to the high priest when he should be telling the high priest the truth, but he didn't. When I was in seminary, Dallas Seminary, back in the 81 to 85, because I love gardening and I had worked for a gardening service when Liz and I first got married, a landscape company, I took a job as on the school grounds crew, and they put me in charge of driving the John Deere tractor to mow all the turf. I couldn't believe that they paid me to do this. It was just... I like to go back and forth, and it was awesome, mowing all the turf at the seminary. And then they found out I like to edge with a weed eater, and I could do it straight for, you know, hundreds of yards, you know. And they're like, you can be the weed eater guy too. So after you mow all the turf, weed eat the campus. That took about 3 hours with a weed eater doing this thing. I can do this thing forever. I still, even at my house. So I did all that, and then they found out that I wasn't afraid of heights, so they put me in charge of climbing the trees in the seminary with a chainsaw. And thinning the trees out around the campus to allow more light in for the turf. I'm good. And so they had like a 30-foot ladder, and I would go up the 30-foot ladder and climb around the trees. This is before gear, like climbing gear. This is where you had to really know your salvation was secure. And if you ever wonder where my grip came from, kind of like that, holding on for dear life with a chainsaw. So one day they told me, we want to have another guy. You're like, you need a backup in case something happens, you know. So we needed to train Larry. That's his name. That's his real name, Larry. You need to train Larry. Take him up the tree. Show him what to do. I'm like, okay. So got Larry. This is so funny. And we go up the tree. I go up first, got the chainsaw, go up the tree. Larry follows me. We go into the tree, climb all around for about 2 hours, 2.5 hours, thinning the tree out, making cuts, dropping branches down below us so we don't hit buildings and things so our crew can come and then haul them away. And we're having a good time. We're just cutting and sawing and climbing around. And so we went back, eventually went back over to the ladder, and I told Larry, I'm going down first. I got the chainsaw, and so I'll hold it while I'm going down with one hand, and then you just follow me. He said, yeah, that's cool. So I went down, and I got about, 10, 15 rungs down, and I can feel the ladder moving as I'm moving, but I don't feel it moving when I'm not moving. I mean, he's not moving. So I look back up the ladder, and he's at the top of the ladder. That's when I wish I would have had a cell phone. You know, you miss all that good stuff back in the day, back in the 80s when they had no cell phones, you know? And so he's up at the ladder, and he's holding on to the two top side rails, and he's staring straight out at the horizon, and he's just... I looked around the ladder. It's total fear. And so I yelled back up at him. I'm like, hey, man, what's going on? And he told me, he goes, he's still looking straight out. He goes, I cannot move. What do you mean you can't move? He said, I'm telling my legs, you know, like to move, and they ain't moving, man. And I said, like what happened? He said, dude, I'm frozen in fear. Oh. So what's a Christian to do? Just tell him, hey, it's too bad for you. I'll see you later. I'm a seminary student, you know. I'm on holy ground, Dallas Seminary. So I told him, I said, okay, I'll tell you what. I'll climb back up, and I'm going to grab your belt loop on your Levi's, and I'm going to hold on your belt loop and hold on to the saw, and I'm going to carry you down the ladder. And so I said, when I move, dude, you're moving. You're coming with me. And I got Larry out of that tree. Do you think that he ever went in another tree? No. You could ask him all day long. Hey, you want to go climb the tree? I ain't going up. No. I don't want to freeze. Because when you become absolutely fearful, like when the hair stands up on the back of your neck, you ever had this happen? No one? It makes you do weird things. So David's doing really weird things with his life because he's not turning to God. He's turning to himself. Fear is overtaking him, and he's making all kinds of bad decisions, which leads to the request that he makes from the high priest. What's the request? He says, now therefore, he tells the priest, hey, what do you have on hand? I'm hungry. I mean, honestly, a Five Guys at Taco Bell. I need some food. What do you have on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread or whatever can be found. This is so lame. The high priest always had bread. How did David, and David knew this. The question is kind of a joke. The high priest always has bread. What bread? The table of showbread bread. The 12 loaves that you put out there every day. And on Shabbat, you take those loaves out and you give them to the priest. The priest eat that bread. And then the fresh bread is given to God. He always has bread. So he says, what do you have on hand? I need... Me and my men need 5 loaves of bread. If I was the priest, that's when the spidey senses something, right? Or the baloney meter goes off. It's like, oh, wait a minute, David, and you have troops with you, and you guys only want 5 loaves? When you know I've got 12, there's something fishy going on here. Ahimelech listens to this and says in verse 4, he answered David and said, hey, well, there's no ordinary bread on hand, but there is what bread? Consecrated bread. That's the table of showbread bread. If only the young men have kept themselves from women. Oh, now this is interesting. He says, I'll tell you what, there's a table of showbread bread that is donated to God. It's God's bread. It's holy bread. Okay. And I will bend the rules to allow you to eat it. But there's one caveat. What was the caveat? Well, any of you or your troops cannot have had a sexual relationship with your wives because then you're unclean. So when we know God made men and women, right? We know this. You're thinking about it? Yeah, he did. And then he married them, and he gave them a sexual ability to populate the earth. It was his first command in the Old Testament was to do that. So we know that marriage and sex and all that stuff is good. But we know from Levitical law, when you study the book of Leviticus, when a person had a sexual relationship, they are unclean because in the transmission of things in sex, well, I'm not going to explain things in detail, there's a form of death in that. And so that made the person unclean. So the only way they could get clean after the fact was to then do ceremonial, ritualistic things to get clean before God. So the priest said, I'll bend the rules with one proviso. You you have to have been away from women, so you're not unclean to touch the holy bread. What is the priest doing here? Well, from a philosophical standpoint, he's looking at what we've looked at before. It's called graded absolutism. Graded absolutism. What does that mean? In a moral situation, there's absolutes that are absolutely true all times. The world might think truth is relative. God says, no, truth is absolutely true. And these things never change. But the thing is, in certain moral situations, there's moral conflict between those absolutes. And so in those kinds of situations, you must evaluate the moral mandates. And if you're in a tough situation, you might have to choose one or the other, i.e. like the midwives with Pharaoh. Pharaoh said, kill all the male Hebrew babies. What did they do? They lied to Pharaoh and said, we're not doing that. And they spared all the Hebrew babies, and we got Moses, and God blessed those women. Why did they do that? Human life is more important than telling the truth to Pharaoh. See? And so Ahimelech is a wise man, and he says, in this situation, David and his troops need to live and have life. That's more important than this stale bread right here that's donated to God. God will understand. Jesus is going to come along and use this in argument in Luke chapter 6. He's out with his disciples one day walking on the hills, and there's grain blowing in the wind, and his disciples are hungry. And so he allows them on Shabbat to pick this grain and eat it because they're hungry. And then the Pharisees, the legalists, see this and castigate Jesus for breaking Shabbat rules by allowing his men to work on the Sabbath. How are they working? They're gleaning. They're hungry. And so what the Lord does with the Pharisees is he tells them, hey, man, sometimes you have to break ceremonial law to preserve life. And that's more important. My men getting food. And then he's going to tell them in Luke 6, by the way, I'm the Lord of the Sabbath. So I can kind of bend it if I need to promote life. So that's what the high priest is doing. Ahimelech is primed to help David. And so in verse 5, it says, David answered the priest and said to him, well, surely women have been kept from us as previously when I set out and the vessels of the young men were holy, though it was an ordinary journey. How much more than today when their vessels be holy? So the priest gave him the consecrated bread, for there was no bread there but the bread of the presence, the 12 loaves of showbread, which was removed from before the Lord in order to put hot bread in its place when it was taken away. I don't know what kind of bread you like, hot bread or old bread. Yeah, isn't there a difference? Yeah, one of my houses in California, right, there was an empty lot behind us, and behind us they built a Krispy Kreme. That was from Satan. Because they had a little sign that would come on, neon, beep, beep, saying, fresh donuts ready. It was like calling my name. I mean, you could smell the bread cooking in the morning. I sold that house and moved out of town. I mean, I couldn't do it. So he's saying, hey, the priests are supposed to eat the old bread, but we got hot bread here because it's Shabbat. We're going to trade them out. You can absolutely take this and God will not be upset. Interesting. Verse 7. This is kind of weird. All of a sudden, we're talking about David, you know, and the bread and everything. Now, it says one of the servants of Saul was there that day. Oh. He was detained before the Lord, which is interesting. God put him there. Interesting. His name? Doeg the Edomite. Who is he? He's the chief of Saul's shepherds. You know when you're lying and deceiving people, you never know who's listening to what you're doing. And Doeg, an enemy of Israel, because he's an Edomite, and he's under divine ban, because the Edomites were the ones who didn't allow Israel in the Exodus to have safe passage to the Palestine. God is against the Edomites, even though they're kinfolk through Esau. But Saul, in his warped mind, has taken one of their enemies and put him on his staff. That's how you know Saul's not fit to be king. And Doeg is thrown in here in the middle of this story because Doeg is going to listen to what David is saying. And who do you think he's going to tell? Saul. He's going to tell Saul. Because what's going to happen in the next chapter? By the way, I told you to come to that meeting, remember? Yeah, that one? Yeah, I won't be there. I'm just telling you, because I'm going to be in Greece. So if you're looking for me, like, where's the pastor? It's, you know, okay? Just dawn on me. I'm not going to be there. So if you're looking for me, I'm not going to be there. Anyway, back to the sermon. Doeg the Edomite is there. He's on his staff. He should not be on his staff, but he is. So when I come back from Greece in 2 weeks, which is why I threw this in, we're going to talk about the next chapter, which is Saul's going to find out what David was doing with the high priest and how the high priest is going to help David. And Saul's going to say, who will kill the high priest? And all the priests with him, who do you think is going to step up and say, I'll do it? Doeg, the anti-Semite, is going to do it. Anyway, back to the story. David needed food to live on and a weapon to defend himself, according to himself. So he has this sword. He knows the sword of Goliath is a weapon that the priest has, because David, when he killed Goliath and then beheaded him, he took the sword and stuck it in his tent. You cannot tell me David did not know where the sword of Goliath went. That is no normal sword. If the guy's almost 10 feet tall, you think he had like a 2-foot sword? His sword must have been massive. And so I would conjecture that David knew where this sword was, and the sword is with the priest. And so David is going to tell him, I need bread, and I also need a weapon. And so in verse 8, David says to Ahimelech, now is there not a spear or a sword at hand? Don't you have a weapon? And for I brought neither my sword nor my weapons with me, because the king's matter was urgent. I got out of Dodge quickly. I forgot to grab my weapon. Serious? That's another lie. So Ahimelech trusts David. And in verse 9, the priest says to him, well, I've got the sword of Goliath, you know, from the Philistine, whom you killed in the valley of Elah. Behold, it's wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. Ta-da! Or in Hebrew, it's todah. If you would take it for yourself, take it, for there's no other weapon here except this one. Take it. There's nothing like it. Take it. The ephod is what the priest wore that had the Urim and the Thummim in it to tell the will of God, the stones that glowed, yes or no. He says, we can see there's a sword right there. David, you want the sword? What's David say? David says, there is none like it. Give it to me. This thing's huge. There's no way he put this on his hip. He probably had a rope or something tied up, threw it over his back to try to carry this massive thing. I have to ask a couple questions. Number one, did David, the mighty David, who took out Goliath with a slingshot, did he need that sword? Nope. But fear makes you do bizarre things. And he's not thinking straight. You must ask yourself, what's fear doing to you right now? Because as your world crumbles around you from pressure, things are happening. And instead of going to God, you go to fear. What's it doing to you? And what are you going to do about it to get back to faith? David makes some bad decisions. And in verses 10 to 15, this passage ends with what I call the regression. The regression. It says that David arose and fled that day from Saul. And he went where? He went to Achish, who's the king of what? Gath. Who's from Gath? Goliath. Is this a smart decision? Mm-mm. Now, remember I talked about, you know, dumb decisions. He's going to go from Nob, 25 miles down the coastline, to the city of Goliath. I have to ask you, when he walks into town with this massive sword draped to his body, don't you think everybody there knew whose sword that was? Don't you know that every Philistine know who killed Goliath, who had that sword? He's going to go there thinking he's going to hide, because no way Saul's going to look for me in Gath. But everybody in Gath, when he shows up, every Philistine is going to know, David's in town. How do you know? He's got the sword of Goliath. I mean, lame, unbelievable. I have to stop and ask you, because of what fear did to David doing this lame thing. Are you in Gath right now in your life? Things have happened. God's removed supports in your life, and you've made some bad decisions, and now you're in Gath. And you think you're going to hide out there, but things are going to go south on you there because God's trying to get your attention. It says in verse 11, but the servants of Achish said to him, the king, is this not David, the king of the land? Did they not sing this one, this song as they danced, saying, Saul has slain his thousands, David his 10,000s. From the mouth of the Philistines is coming, David's the king, not Saul. How do they know that? Because he's beat us on the battlefield multiple times. And we heard about that song those Jewish girls were singing about him, the one that really got Saul upset. David's listening to all this, and he doesn't connect the dots like the Philistines did. And how does he respond? In verse 12, it said, David took these words to heart, and he greatly feared Achish, king of Gath, So what did he do as he's scared to death they're going to kill him? It says he disguised his sanity before them, and he acted insanely in their hands and scribbled on the doors of the gate, probably with his fingernails, and he let saliva run down his beard. He appeared to be what we might call psycho, crazy, nuts. And so it says in verse 14, Achish, the king, said to his servants when he saw David going, there's David, a picture of him going crazy. He just goes crazy. And so you would think the king's got the head soldier of the Israeli army in his presence. You think he would want to take him out. Achish sees this guy going crazy. And he said to his servants, behold, you see the man behaving as a madman? Why do you bring him to me? Do I lack madmen that you have brought this one to act like a madman in my presence? I mean, isn't the scripture interesting? I mean, what is the king saying? My kingdom has a share of psycho people. And I just, man, I go out in public and I run into him. And you're bringing me one, and he's not even a Philistine, and it's David, and he's gone nuts. Yeah, get him out of here. Now, David, in my estimation, in this situation, this was pretty crafty on his part, and he totally dupes him because they think he's nuts when he really isn't. But he has lost total self-respect for himself. Why? Because he's living in fear. Maybe you're just like that. You've lost total respect for yourself because you're living in fear. That was David. Now, we know that God, and throughout all of this, is trying to get to the heart of David. He's trying to drive Saul out of David's heart and give David a heart that loves God above all things. So David's lost his relationship with Saul. He's lost it with his wife, Michal, because he can't get to her anymore. He's not near Samuel anymore to get close to the prophet and the priest. He can't get near his friend Jonathan. He's lost all those important people in his life, and now he's very alone, and he's made some very bad decisions. And God's like, in the middle of Gath, as your world has imploded, are you going to continue in fear, or are you going to come to me in faith? What's David do? Well, we know that David comes back to the Lord, has what we might call a come-to-Jesus moment. Because he wrote two psalms about his ordeal in Gath, Psalm 34 and Psalm 96. We know he turned his life around in the middle of all of that. Because in the book of Psalms, chapter 56, here's what he writes. And if you read Psalm 56 in the English Bible, it has a header. That header is verse 1 in the Hebrew text. It's inspired. The header reads this. For the choir director, according to Jonath, Alim Royakim. It's a michtam, which means in Hebrew, a covering, to David. When the Philistine seized him in Gath, what did David write in this psalm? Be gracious to me, O God, for man has trampled upon me. Fighting all day long, he oppresses me. My foes have trampled me all day long. They are many who fight proudly against me. When I am afraid, I will put my trust in thee. See the change? He just changed from fear to faith. In God, whose word I praise, in God I have put my trust, I shall not be afraid. What can mere man do to me? You see the change? He switched from bad decisions based on fear to I need the Lord in my life and I'll kneel before him. So in Psalm 56, if you continue to read it, it talks about how God has taken to account my wanderings and he's put my tears in his bottle. It's like God has a special little bottle and he scoops up David's tears that he cried in Gath over how terrible he had acted. And God empowered David. You will see when I come back from Greece that in the next chapter, God will begin to bring people into David's life to position him to do great things again. God wants to do the same thing for you. If you've made dumb decisions and you're in Gath, God is getting your attention there. And he wants you to move away from fear and move back to faith and confess what you've done and look for God to do great things. I close with this one motif, divine principle to live by. When fear causes you to take missteps, realize God's working to order your steps. When you make missteps, sinful steps, it's not over for you. God is, in his grace, looking to order your steps to do greater things. You just have to bend a knee to him and say, God, help me, and he shall.